To overcome, you must educate. Educate not only yourself, but educate anyone seeking to learn. We are all dead America. We can all learn something. To learn, we must challenge what we already understand. The way we do that is through conversation. Sometimes we have conversations with others. However, some of the best conversations happen with ourselves. Reach out and challenge yourself. Let's dive in and learn something new right now. Today we are speaking with Aidan Gabor. He's the author of Conflicting Loyalties. Aidan is an ex-mob enforcer turned DOJ informant. Aidan, could you please introduce yourself? Let people know just a little more about you, please.
How are you doing? So my name's Aidan Gabor. I grew up in a pretty screwed up my childhood and life. Introduced myself as, you know, I started off with working with a crew and eventually worked for the DOJ for taking on bad police officers and politicians, and then finding my love and finding my spiritual journey throughout the process of it all. For somebody that was extremely anti-religious to become religious at the end.
Yeah, I find your story very interesting. And let's start off with your early life, Aidan. It's remarkable how you were young and you were kind of forced into this by the DOJ to become an informant. But those early years, what were those like for you?
I'm going to be honest, it was awesome. My dad was an associate and with a cabo, and I was started out 9-10 years old. We would have gatherings, just barbecues, where the people, mothers and grandmothers from the old country would come in and cook, and we would have everything, and we would, you know, we learned at early age respect. If you were asked to get something, get it for them. You know, and then I was a big for my age, and I would get in those scuffles outside with boys that are 5-6 years older than me, and I would beat up a couple of them, or, you know, get beat up. And in early years, you know, a couple of times we'd be wrestling or fighting on it was gravel, and got cut up. The cops showed up because there had, you know, somebody complaining about kids fighting. And I'm like, you know, like, what, you know, Aidan, come on over, tell us what's going on. I'm like, get the hell out of here. We were wrestling. And I was getting my ass handed to me. I was getting beat up. And I just told them to get up. And they're like, come on now, we know who, I don't know. And then they'd leave, and we go inside. And one day, Eddie, the cop, he asked me, hey, can you stop by the shop? He had a little shop. There's a car, like, you know, a mechanic shop, but it was also like a little social club and stuff they had in there. And eventually I learned later on in life that we had other things going on in there. And I showed up, I rode my bike. And he's like, hey, will you take this package and take it to this place, drop it off, don't talk to anybody, don't stop, and do not look in it. I said, yes, sir. And I took the packages, and I would bring it to people. And I, you know, as you, after time, after doing this several times, I come back, you'd give me money, 20, 30 bucks. I would run at a candy store with my buddies, and I'd be king. You know, we'd get $30 worth of candy. And back then, that was a lot of candy. And I did this for a while. And eventually, you know, you recognize these people. And as I got older, I worked my way up. Eddie saw something in me. And I started cleaning in the store. Did a little like, but I wasn't dropping something. I'd sweep the store, take garbage out. You know, I got a couple scuffles with a couple guys in there, and because they treat me like shit. And I was one not to take it. And so I just worked my way up. And eventually Eddie saw something in me. So we had a guy there I didn't put in the book. His name's Nikki. And Nikki taught me how to use a gun, how to use an ice pick, and how you put the, I mean, back then, you put this right in the back here, right? And you could do this And he told me when I speak, you can stab somebody 5 or 6 times really quick, run away, leave it in. It doesn't leave prints, and they're more worried about that. You can get away. And at that time, I'm thinking there's something wrong with this guy. And taught me how to drive. You know, here I am doing all this. And Eddie just saw something in me. And he eventually I worked my way up to, I learned that we were collecting from like little mom pop places and little shops. I started doing that with a guy named Dominic. And Dominic and I really didn't care for each other. First time I met Dominic, he pushed me really hard into the wall to get out of the way. And I grabbed a broom handle and I hit him with it. And then he hit me and he turned with the gun. And Eddie's like, no, stop. Like a Boris kid. And they're like, oh, and he walked away. And the first time I went with Dominic, we're in the car and I'm in the passenger. He punches me as hard as he can in the face. And it was like, you know, you feel the like blackness and all that. He said, that's for when you hit me. We're not even, but you know, that's what you get. You know, don't start your shit. Anyway, I learned how to collect, and then I became an enforcer of people because they had gambling, they had prostitution. I wasn't allowed to go buy the prostitution because I was an adolescent, you know, with girls. I was learning about girls at the time, and they didn't want me to go buy that. And so we ran numbers, we loaned money, and we collected. And then they had a chop shop. That was our big thing. The biggest thing with Eddie was a chop shop. And I learned how to steal cars, and I did that. My first car I stole was 15. And first of all, the second time I stole a car, some clown came up to me to ask me what I was doing. He's going to call the cops, and I kind of tuned him up a little bit and left, and never heard anything on that. And then I was enforcing, and there was a couple times. I mean, my most remembering time was we were sitting at a deli outside, and this guy is walking by, and Eddie goes, hey, that motherfucker owes me 20 grand. I think it's what he said, 10 or 20. And I just start running, and I run up to the guy, and I hit him, and I start kicking the crap out of him. This Dominic's like, well, chill. And then I'm beating the crap out of him. And Dominic, you better get back, or it's going to get worse. And he looked at me, and he goes, you're eating your sandwich. And I'm looking at him and go, yeah, it's a good corned beef sandwich. I'm losing a sandwich. I love this thing's great. But you just beat up a guy eating your sandwich. Are you kidding me? He's like, dude, get the fuck back. So, you know, we go back there and he looking and he's telling Eddie this. And he goes, well, good. We'll call him Sandwich. And I thought, to this day, I hate that name. I became Aiden Sandwich Gaborn. I hated that name. And that's what they gave me. And that's what it ran with. And I did all that. I did all the way up till I was almost 18 going on 19. Actually, 19 going on 20, I should say, because I was a little late. And the next thing I know, you know, I was collecting. I enforced, did everything I'm supposed to do. Beat up, I got stabbed a couple times doing this. I all of a sudden, Eddie comes, he said, hey, the FBI just arrested Dominic. They took Nick. I think Nick got away. I think Nick took off. And anyway, he's like, I'm leaving. You got a chance. You haven't been arrested yet. You've got a chance to go play college football. Go make something of yourself. And I wasn't planning on it. And I'm like, okay, because you got to go because you're probably out here. So basically, we're done. So basically, the whole thing went down for that, and I went to school, and that was the end of my first part of my life, or the early part when I worked with where I was running with the crew.
Yeah, that's a lifestyle that many people fear, but as you live in that lifestyle of crime and that activity, it really makes you a different person. That's for sure. Growing up in the 70s myself, I remember when RICO came out and, you know, the big cases during the 80s with RICO. Everyone was terrified at that point because it was guilt by association. And, you know, everybody was friendly at that time and everybody knew everybody. It was a different time. And I really think that during that time frame of fear, things really shifted in the not only loyalties, but communities. They buttoned up, per se. What do you think about that, Aiden?
Oh, absolutely. You know, we had, you know, we worked with the gang, so there was no, the crime was nothing. You know, they, like, you know, we were told, Eddie's like, we don't do drugs. And I can't say the exact words, but he said, let the gangs give to their own community, you know, and but in different words. And we were like, did we get a percentage? We did something. We didn't poach. You know, we worked kind of together. And it was safe back then. There was no problems, you know. Everything was, you could walk the streets at any time. There's respect, you know. That was what I loved about it, respect part of it, you know. Through everything, you know, going through, yeah, the minute Rico came in, and I was the same time frame. And as soon as that came in, yeah, it changed everything. That's what happened to us. You know, FBI just came and cleaned the house. And they hurt more, I think, more communities, yes, where we get money from the people, but they were safe. You know, once all that ended, it became a free-for-all. You know, and that's because, you know, the government wants, I'm gonna tell you right now, it's the government wants their money. They're not getting money out of this. And that was the whole thing I'm looking at. I mean, the crime part, you're going to get that all the time. But it's the greedy part of the government. And that's my thinking of it. But, you know, I don't understand, you know. And then you're right. The RICO law was, you don't have to do anything. You just have to be associated with somebody. And that was it, you know.
Yeah, that was a big, big point in my history that I remember vividly, because I remember the fear that ran through myself because of my activities. And it's the same thing. My family believed in taking care of business. If you wronged, well, you're going to find one of us at your door or in your bedroom. And, you know, it's just how we handled things. My brother, you know, that just passed away recently, he spent many years in prison for using a hatchet on somebody instead of the baseball bat. You know, the severity of these crimes, you know, that fear that came in, it really did take a lot of that and put it on the back burner, per se, because I remember it was pretty open back then. You know, you knew who you were dealing with because they demanded that respect. And you talk quite a bit about respect in your interviews. And I love this portion because I really think that's what we're lacking today is respect. My mother and my father instilled in us, you don't hit a woman, you respect the woman, you respect your elders. And, you know, I really miss those times. And I think a lot of what occurred in our legal streams really screwed the family up. And then you got into everyone calling the cops on everyone, and it really divided the families in a way.
Oh yeah, absolutely. You know, respect growing up, that was it, you know, family respect. That was the way it went. And nowadays these kids nowadays have zero respect. You know, I get in trouble in my old age dealing with these kids nowadays. They talk their shit, and I'm not one. I really didn't take too much crap. And you're right. We took care of business. If you wronged family and or close friends, you're expecting my happy face to show up. And that way I used to say is like, oh, you beat up these people. You did this. You know, yeah, I used a baseball bat, but we weren't kinky. We weren't rocket scientists. We we used what we had at hand. And the best thing I learned is have a baseball bat, put a mitt and a ball in your trunk, and you cannot be arrested because you had a baseball. Oh, yeah, I'm ready to play baseball at any time. And I used to, yes, I used a baseball bat. And I like hitting the ankles because when you hit those feet, you get the tires, they go down. When you hit the knees, they only kind of, they might be able to get up. It's going to hurt. But him and the ankles, they're on the ground and you got total control of them. And that, and they made a different sound. I liked it. And that was me growing up. I'm going to admit to it. And, you know, I did other things, but you wronged the family. And most of the time, if you see my happy mug showing up at your place, it wasn't because I picked you out just randomly. It's because you did something for me to be here. You borrowed money and didn't pay it back. You did something, you know. And everybody talks about different crews. You know, we did violence mostly against other crews because they're poaching in our territory. You know, if you're going to go poach in somebody else's territory, do some business, you better have a good reason or you're going to pay consequences. And that's like nowadays, there is no consequences for what you do. There is no respect. There is, and that's the way these kids are nowadays. They're little shits. And I big respect. You know, like I say it every time, I have never said a word against anybody I ran with, anybody in the crew. I never did anything against them. If they were to ask me, I would have told them to get fucked. But I did things against bad police officers and bad politicians. That was what, yes, did I inform against them? Absolutely. But I grew up seeing these people, and they were supposed to be protecting people. And then in the second part of life, when the DOJ came up and gave me that lovely ultimate, I wouldn't say ultimatum, they had basically a deal I couldn't refuse at the time, that, yeah, you know, eventually I figured I'm doing good, you know, but I did miss my younger life. I enjoyed doing it because we had respect in the neighborhood. The neighborhoods were safe. People said, hey, how you doing? You know, you got a lot of shit free, but you also had, like I said, the respect thing.
Yeah, I like that a lot. And it really appealed to me when I seen this come across the desk for the first time. The title of your book, you know, it suggests conflicting loyalties. Is your loyalty still conflicting, or do you have a better grasp on your ideas and who you are and what you are?
You know, I do now. I think spiritually helped me, but when the conflicting loyalties part mostly came in is, you know, when the DOJ came up and used that RICO thing against me, and they're like, this is a new, you know, when they show me pictures of my mother, my father, you know, when they show a picture of me and my father with Eddie and a bunch of other guys, I didn't care. But when they show me my mother and say my mother's going to go to jail, unless I did it, that hit me because I'm a mama's boy. I was. My mom was passed. And they said, hey, you ever heard of this law called RICO? Well, no, I was young. It's a new law out there. He goes, you're a college boy. Go look it up in the library. You know, back then, 70s, you didn't have that shit. So I went and found out what it was. I'm like, holy shit. And that, I'm sorry, it killed me in first time. And I said, yes, I'll do what you need me to do. And, you know, these two clowns had me, you know, infiltrate a police department to find a police officer. The first one was a hitman. And what happened with the conflicting loyalties part is, when you become in law enforcement, after I started, you get on the academy and you go through, there's a thing called the blue line, as you start knowing, in law enforcement. And it's this blue line, almost like we had, where you don't talk about your brothers and sisters. If you see something, kind of keep it to yourself. You know, that type of deal. Unless it's extremely bad. But my conflicting loyalties part was, as I'm doing all of this, I'm thinking to myself, am I betraying my brothers and sisters in blue? And when my first time I started to do it, the first one I went after, it took me over a year, and I became a drinker. And yeah, I drank, but I became a gulper, I guess you could say. That's the way this idiot was, Terry. And after I put away, when they got me to work at the department I grew up in, and since I remember the politicians, the commissioners, and the officers that I saw as a kid, taking the money, telling them what's going on, doing some very bad crimes. And for Eddie, that I thought, you know, like I said, the DOJ came to me. It wasn't to be undercover. It was just an informant. I didn't have backup. So I had to do all this and no, tell anybody. Don't you say a word to your parents. Don't say a word to your wife or anybody. Or if you do, you go, that's it. The deal's off. You're going to jail. And, you know, as you become a drinker, it started against me. I started seeing hallucinations of St. Michael with the flaming sword coming at me, said, I betrayed, and slicing at me. And in that time frame, I started becoming an alcoholic. But then I started getting those benders. And I remember waking up, and I remember, was I hallucinating or doing, putting a round in the chamber of 357, spinning it, and putting it to my head, and pulling the trigger, or putting it underneath my chin, pulling the trigger. And I knew of at least 200 some times I did it remembering, and times I wake up with two or three in the gun laying on the floor next to me, thinking I do this over 1,000 times, try to kill myself. And, you know, later life, I'm learning that God didn't want me to die, you know, and my conflicting loyalties part was, I'm conflicting against my brothers and sisters in blue. I'm taking no other bad police officers. That was a part. The politicians, I didn't give a shit. But going against police officers, am I going against the guys? Because as you walk in their shoes as a law enforcement, and you know, I still did the job. And you get to see dealing with what they would deal with every day in life, you know. And people don't understand this. Let's defunct them. They don't do it. Are you kidding me? What these men and women do? It's like the military. Why these people treat the military personnel the way they do? Law enforcement, first responders. You know, what these men and women do for you. You know, I've talked to many military people, and you know, this is what they get. They train, kill, 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 train, kill, kill, kill. Oh, it's all done with, go back and be a normal person in society after you've seen and did what you did. Seriously? That's how I look at it. Why do these people have mental, I mean, I didn't see the carnage they may have seen. Have I seen carnage? Yes. But have I, you know, been involved? Yes. But not in the same way these guys were. And I was very young when I did a lot of this stuff. And in law enforcement, you see it. You see the abuse, you see the murders, you see everything. And some people can't take that mentally, and I understand it, but they want you to be a normal, functioning human being after your shift is over or after your tour is over. And my conflicting, like I said, my conflicting loyalty was that, you know, and I became a bad alcoholic, and my buddy Don and Sam saved my ass with the alcoholism.
Well, thank God for Don and Sam. You know, it is. It's interesting you bring this up about law enforcement. You know, my whole family was criminal to the T, but I really don't get into that. I really looked at what was happening, and I kind of got sick because of it. And then, interestingly enough, I met my wife. I was 17 years old, and she was a Christian, and she kind of stepped in and changed who I was, and my life hasn't been the same ever since. And I heard that you found that same type of experience with your second wife. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah. I was, you know, I was extremely, I mean, I was an asshole. I was not a great person. My first wife, I was not a great husband. I was not a great father. I didn't believe in religion. I used to joke, I worked for the other guy. I would collect souls. And I met her, and she you know, she looked at me and accepted me. And then, you know, we would go out. And the first several dates, you know, a friend of mine said, hey, you need to go out. She wants to go out with her. I go, seriously? Why would she want to go out with me? She goes, I don't know. She thinks you're funny. You know, I joke around with everybody, and I said, all right, I'll go out with her. And it was just one of those clicks. And I'm going to be telling you that this is kind of a funny story is we went out. I didn't pay for anything on the first eight dates. She probably thought I was some kind of Sam. Like, and we joke about this now, but she said she liked me. We went out. I always had an excuse. I was going through a divorce. Because I felt bad for you. And then eventually you're like a fungus. I couldn't get rid of you. And she understands you. She accepted me for who I am and what I was. And, you know, she may have not gotten me when I was younger and my prime and fit and all this. You know, I got ALS. I'm falling apart. I was shot a couple times. I mean, like, she's getting the used car part, and she accepted it. And, you know, the funniest thing about her is when I started in law enforcement, I was a young officer. I arrested a 16-year-old at a bar. I bring this person to jail. She's in the backseat kind of crying, but kind of being a bitch. And I'm trying to talk to her. She's really not talking to me. So at that time, I took her picture, took her prints. And back then, I was making my extra sentence up for my own files to say, you know, we get, you know, keep your own files in case something happens and, you know, kind of like control. Do you know, I arrested her when she was 16 years old. And then we met again, like 15 years later. It's what else was secret. And I didn't realize it till her uncle said something to me about, hey, she got arrested at that town. I'm like, seriously? She's like, yeah, we used to live there years ago. I remember that. And he's explaining it to me. So I looked it up and sure enough, it was me. I was like, so what's that? Sika Nika, whatever the hell they call it. Yeah. So that's how I met her. But she just understood me. And to this day, she accepts me for what I am. And, you know, we click. We talk every day. We talk every day, of course, but we talk as much as we can. And we still say, I love you every morning. And my first wife was like, you know, Satan's daughter. And that's how I used to joke. I married Satan's daughter because she was. She's just a mean bitch. But, yeah, you're right. I'm glad you met yours, too, you know. Accept you for your quirks, even though you may be, you know, a little bit out there. They accept you.
It's a beautiful thing when you find the right woman. And it's interesting how they don't really change you. I think you really change together. You know, that's the big thing. Writing the book, Aiden, you talk about it being therapy. And I find podcasting therapy because I really don't have the talent yet to finish and complete a book, but I'm seeking that. So do you talk to us about the therapy end of releasing this through a book or even these podcasts that you are doing?
You know, I what happened was I was having night terrors, and I still have them. And I was swinging, I was throwing my wife around, I was punching the wall, I was punching at some. And she called Don and Sam and said, hey, you guys, this is what he's doing. And they came out and they flew down and saw me. And Don's just like, you know, dude, come on, you know, you need to look at this and you need to maybe look at some religion. I'm like, go to hell. And Sam looks at me and goes, you need religion. And Sam's like, read these books. And Don's like, I got to go. We're talking about it. You know, what's going on? He was here for a couple days. Sam stayed for a couple weeks. And he's like, read this. And there was Abdul Baha'i, the Baha'i faith. And I'm like, oh, I don't like reading, but okay, I'll read this. And then we started talking. And then he never knew, you know, I grew up with Sam. I mean, we grew up in the neighborhood. He never knew the shit. He goes, I always wrote off, but I knew your dad did work, but I didn't know you were going. And he's like, well, no. And him and I talked about, you know, life, because I knew a lot of people. He goes, yeah, I remember some things happened when we were there. And we were like, wow. And he goes, your life screwed up. I go, gee, thanks. I love hearing that. And he's just like, you need to write a book. I go, go to hell. I ain't writing this book. I don't want to because therapeutically, get it all out. I go, I'm going nuts now. He goes, yeah, but you get it all out. And yes, I wrote the book. It took a couple of years because it's a memoir. Oh, I forgot about that. Oh, yeah, you know, did I have this? Oh, you know, we also did that. You know, you remember little parts here and there. And yeah, I wrote the book, and he's like, geez, it helped you therapeutic? And I'm like, no, it's not. But yeah, it is. You know, it's one of those yes and no's. And he said, you know, doing a podcast, yes, it's helping me. Am I having as many night terrors? And no, I'm not. And which is surprising me because I'm remembering more and more of the stuff I did. I didn't want to remember both in being a criminal and both being in law enforcement. You know, I always joked that I was in the dark. I was in the shadows, my young life. And I was in the medium shadows growing up. And eventually when I found the Baha'i faith, I came in out of the dark into the light and realized, whoa, you know, the Baha'i faith, men and women are exactly equal. Where in some Catholic faiths, the woman is subservient to the man, you know, in the Baptist faith, you know, faith. And I believe everybody's equal. I've always believed that. And there's a lot of things the Baha'is believe, but I'm like, whoa, yeah, everybody bleeds red, you know, whether they're white, pink, black, purple, green. We all bleed red. We bleed a different color. We got some problems. And that's how I want. That's what I believe in. And Sam looked at me and goes, see, you were always a Baha'i your whole life. You just didn't know it. And so I started reading it. And one day I'm sitting outside, you know, and I get this one. I'm reading the Abdul Baha'i's writing. And I look up, I get this feeling in me, and I'm like, I'm looking at the sun, it's hot out, and I'm thinking, oh, it's got to be getting sunstroke or something. I'm going in, my wife's like, Serena's like, what's going on? I go, I don't know, there's something inside me. I'm reading about the Baha'i's writings, I got this feeling and all that, fucking bullshit, I hate it. And she's like, you're getting spiritual. I'm going, go to hell, I'm not getting spiritual here. I hate this feeling. Oh no, that's what you're getting. And I kept reading, you know, I'm not a great reader. So she started reading to me and she's like, see, and then the Baha'i faith, there's a thing called Rui, a Rui class, which is a Bible class. So for 3 years, my wife did these Rui classes with me twice a week, 1 hour, twice a week, 2 hours a week. And she did it. She went through it, read it. Did everything with it, but she never converted from her Catholic or, you know, Christian beliefs to, you know, a Baha'i, even though I did. But she stayed with me to help me read, to help me understand for 3 years. She never, and that's where we talked about our wives understanding us and helping us. That right there showed a lot. And then me learning spiritually, you know, and I always joke that, you know, God never let me kill myself. I tried as many times. I got stabbed. I got shot. God said, yeah, you ain't dying. That God's got a sense of humor because I went through all this shit and now I got ALS. So he's like, yeah, guess what, sunshine? The best is yet to come for you. So I get it. You know, he's got a sense of humor and I accept it. I didn't care if I died. I didn't care if I died at all. Now I want to live because I've learned to help people. I've actually, you know, which I never thought in a million years, I do a lot with Special Olympics, with these special needs men and women. I mean, they're not kids, they're men and women. But my God, if the world can see through their eyes, because they just want to hug you. Oh, there's Aiden. Oh, there's my friend. And they come up, Aiden. Oh, they don't know. They don't care about what I did as a living. They just care. I'm their friend. You know, they understand if you hurt them, that person hurt me. I don't like them. They understand when they get hurt, but they understand, hey, this is a nice person. I like them. And I love that. It's like, you know, it's just a warmth I get. And I love helping and I love doing the Special Olympics and seeing. These kids are never going to be Olympians, but yes, they are. And in their heart, they are because they're so awesome when they get that excitement. They don't care if they came in last, they came in first.
I like that a lot. You know, it was one of my most fulfilling experiences in life to be able to work with the mentally handicapped. And I worked with an agency through work program at high school, and it was called the Star of Hope. And I learned so much because of working with those individuals. It really taught me a lot. I like it. So now that you've written a book and you're still currently in law enforcement, I believe, do you have plans to write another book with, you know, a theme for the Boys in Blue in some form?
You know, I'm not in law enforcement. I retired after 17 years. You know, I always thought of writing something that would be like, but you know, writing on, I would love to write something to show the positive side of law enforcement. But the problem is the positive side that they do, people don't care. I mean, it's the blood and guts that they care about. And I've already done something kind of like that. So I'm not sure how I would approach that. Do I want to write? Yes, I do. I mean, my book, I can write more stories on what I did. I only put a fraction of what I did my early years. I only put a fraction of what I did in law enforcement. And I've only done a fraction of my finding my true love and the same thing with the Baha'i faith. I don't know. I would love to write another book, but I haven't decided what I would do. You know, I learned a long time ago, you know, my mom and dad were partisans during World War II, and they were in Budapest, Hungary. So they went through the Russians, the Nazis, and then they went through, you know, the 56, the revolution. And my dad, a couple years ago, my dad and I didn't talk when he found out I became a flatfoot. He didn't talk to me for 10 years. He's like, "You're be a fucking flatfoot. Get out of my house." That was his last words for 10 years. We finally talked again. We met someplace. And him and I had a chat. And he goes, you know, did your mother ever scare you growing up? I go, "What do you mean?" "She scared the hell out of me my whole life. There was just something about her." And I'm like, "Yeah, there's always something about my mom. You know, I've only two people scared me my whole life. I'm not scared of no man. I was scared of my mother. I'm scared of my current wife. And those two are the only two people scared the shit out of me." And I'm like, "Why?" And my dad's like, "Yeah, you know, we went against Nazis, you know, when the Germans were in there. We went against the Russians when they invaded in, you know, the 45. She said, "Your father, when the Russian, or your mother, when the Russians came in to her and her sisters, what they did to them, never left her. She was always with her. She was always haunting her because she always, when storms came, the Russians are coming. They're going to do this again to us. Your mother was so much that at 10, 11 years old, she would go out there and walk out there at night. And a couple of Russian soldiers see her like, 'Come here, little girl. What are you doing out here?' And they were doing, and she would carry this long spear. As they talked, she stabbed them through the neck real fast, both of them, and take off running. And if there's one crawling, she stabbed him again until he stopped crawling and run away. They said, "Your mother used to do that. I can't remember. A couple hundred times, she just stabbed these Russian soldiers. Or she'd take and go right up to a tank and throw a Molotov cocktail onto the roof of a tank and jump off where everybody else would run and throw it from 20 feet away. She didn't care. She wanted to see him suffer." And your mother had that. And I learned a long time ago that you could have that where what your parents did as a young age could be hereditary for you at a young age growing up. You know, and I'm going to be honest, where I went through psychological, you know, evaluation, and it came back to, I have no empathy for people. I really don't. And I'm a borderline sociopath. And, you know, that's growing up in the environment I grew up in. But the no empathy, they can't figure out. To this day, I fight bad with it. When somebody gets hurt, I don't. My wife and I can't watch horror movies or bad movies because I laugh. To me, when somebody's head's getting snapped off, their arm breaking, they're torturing them, I laugh. I think it's funny. And I don't know why. My wife's like, "I can't watch this movie with you. What do you think? It's a comedy? You're a fucking ass." And walk away. And if I see something, no, that's not how you break a leg. Let me tell you what it sounds like. I'm not listening to your shit. And walk away. And I thought I had that. You know, you were talking about, maybe a book. I might do something on partisans growing up, what my dad, who's still alive, could find out more. Because I asked a friend, I didn't believe my dad. I thought he was full of shit. So I called a friend of theirs that lived in New York. And I asked him, he's like, who told you? Or, he goes, your father did. I go, yeah. He goes, no, she did. That's what, she was crazy. She said, that was one of the craziest women I ever met, you know. And he kind of laughed before he passed. He told me all about. Yeah, it's true. And your dad's not shitting here. But besides that, your dad's still alive? I'm like, yeah, he's still kicking. All right. And that was it. You know, I'm like, oh my God. You know, is this explains a little bit. But, you know, my mom growing up, I think knew what I was doing, but didn't give a shit. So, I mean, I'm thinking about it, but I'm not sure what.
Yeah. I think you have a few more in you with all that you've been through. That's for sure. And they say once you write one, you have to write another. So I would be very interested in seeing more come from you. Could you tell people how to get the book?
Absolutely. You can get it on conflictingloyalties.com. We have everything on there. Conflictingloyalties.com tells you every mantra you get it from. We'll send you to it, and that's your best place to get it rather than scrolling through everything in Amazon and all that. But at conflictingloyalty.com, you get on Amazon, it'll tell you right there, and it tells you how to get to it.
Aiden, I think you're doing marvelous things. I call people like you bridge builders because you're bridging that chasm that people need to get over. And those younger people, you can help a lot. And I appreciate a lot what you're doing. Taking the time to come on these podcasts and write a book. It's all about helping people grow. And I really find that very unique about you. Thank you for being part of the Dead America podcast with us here today.
Ed, thank you so much for having me. And, you know, if you ever need anything else, let me know, sir. And I'll let you know if I write another book.
I would be very excited to talk to you about it. And thank you once again, Aiden.
Thank you again, Ed. You have a great day and be safe, sir.
You also, sir.
Thank you for joining us today. If you found this podcast enlightening, entertaining, educational in any way, please share, like, subscribe, and join us right back here next week for another great episode of the Dead America Podcast. I'm Ed Waters, your host. Enjoy your afternoon, wherever you might be.